This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 2020 Atlantic hurricane season begins in less than a month. Researchers are predicting as many as 22 named storms could form in the Atlantic Basin this year. But of course, it only takes one to endanger communities already affected by the stress of the pandemic. Robert Young is the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. He's a geologist and a researcher of coastal processes. Welcome back, Rob.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you? Staying safe?
I am. And I appreciate you talking with us. So now this hurricane season predicted to be very active. What do we mean by that, and how do we know?
Well, this is a game that a lot of academic researchers like to play at the beginning of every hurricane season, trying to see if we can prognosticate the number of storms and how many of them will turn into big ones. There's really two things that drive the activity of a hurricane season in the Atlantic Basin. One is how much heat is available in the ocean, and the researchers have noticed that seawater temperatures are abnormally high for this time of year and have been for a couple of months. It's that heat that fuels the development of tropical systems. And the second thing that they're looking for is the degree of wind shear across the Atlantic Basin, because the development of strong tropical systems and hurricanes is enhanced when you have low wind shear. And for that, we're looking to the El Niño-La Niña cycle all the way over in the Pacific. And during El Niño years, the wind shear in the Atlantic Basin is relatively high. And during the opposite of El Niño, the La Niña, the wind shear is low. And so I guess right now most experts see both a lot of heat in the ocean and the potential for a strong La Niña signal during this hurricane season, which means that we would tend to have an above average number of tropical systems and an above average number of them developing into hurricanes.
And just to try to understand what this means, there's so with the La Niña, we have less shear, which would mean kind of less disturbance, less ability to break up a storm. Is that it? So they're more likely to form because there's less to interfere with them?
That's absolutely right. You know, when you think of the strong hurricanes that have hit the U.S. East Coast, like Hurricane Hugo or Andrew, these are very symmetrical storms. They like to be well organized, and that's how they can develop this, you know, very strong wind speeds, low central pressure. And for that, they need to be in a low wind shear environment. When you have a lot of wind moving in the upper atmosphere, it tends to rip the storms apart and prevents them from organizing.
Right. So then this means, in a sense, and how do we determine the danger? Because I know, I think last year we really began to talk about the fact that this category, the category numbers are really not helpful in determining what our emergency management should be. You know, what should we be looking at? And is there anything at this time of the year, anything in those predictions that we make now that can help emergency managers?
Well, so that's a really good point, Frank. I think, you know, the storm of record for South Florida still was Hurricane Andrew. I'm sure you remember that storm. Mm-hmm. It was like a gigantic tornado almost. It was incredibly devastating. Well, you know, Hurricane Andrew hit during the 1992 hurricane season when there were just seven storms. Mm. So the message here is that all of the guesswork about how many tropical systems we're going to have this year and how many of them will develop into large hurricanes, it's interesting to some degree from an academic point of view, but if I'm an emergency manager, you know, I want to be preparing for that worst-case scenario every single year, no matter what the forecasts are. From my professional opinion, to some degree, all of this guesswork about the number of storms and how strong they're going to get, it's really interesting from an academic perspective, but from an emergency manager's perspective on the ground, you need to be ready for that big storm every single year to the same degree no matter what.
I suppose, but I guess there's the what kind of bigness, because if there are going to be a few storms with a lot of wallop, then winds might be my problem, although obviously the water storm surge is always a part of it. If there's going to be a lot of little storms that are going to carry plenty of water, just the fact that they're Category 2 doesn't, you know, matter much, well, then I might want to prepare more for water damage than wind damage. I don't know. Is that a sensible thing, or am I never going to be an emergency manager with that kind of thinking?
Well, I really wish that we could glean that kind of information from these forecasts. But, you know, they still don't tell us which hurricane is going to make landfall.
Right.
A lot of these, we may be lucky, and they just may spin off into the Atlantic. And it doesn't tell us where. And, you know, the where and the which hurricane, those are the things that are really ultimately going to determine whether we're dealing with a windstorm or a water storm or a rain bomb like we've seen in the state of North Carolina over the last 5 years. So, you know, it's interesting, but there isn't a lot of actionable information in there for an emergency manager.
Well, why don't we talk to somebody who really does know what they're doing about this, an emergency manager. Right now I'm talking to Rob Young. He knows a lot. He's the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. But, of course, preparing for hurricane season is hard enough in a normal year, and the coronavirus is adding new complications this season. Emergency managers are hard at work to handle one crisis, and now they're preparing for another. Stephanie Chavis is director of Robeson County Emergency Management. She keeps county residents informed of hurricane risks and puts worst-case scenario plans into place and is with us now. Stephanie, welcome. Hello, Stephanie. Well, we'll get Stephanie back on the line in just a moment and talk with her more about that. But Rob, while I have you here, give us a sense of what it is we're looking at. So you talked a little bit about the fact that we've got, you can look at wind shear and kind of what that's like and the climate pattern we're in, the amount of energy. And I wonder to what extent, the climate change, and I know this gets controversial, shouldn't be, is playing a part in either the number or the intensity of these storms.
Well, I think it's pretty clear at this point that climate change is definitely playing a role in the warming of the surface waters of the ocean, and that is the fuel for these hurricanes. So the climate change is not playing a significant role in this El Niño-La Niña pattern, but the developing hurricanes that are stronger, more intense, maybe larger, storms that are holding more water and can drop a lot more precipitation, we clearly see a climate change signal in those kinds of impacts. So it's not necessarily with the number of storms and the way that they can develop, but in the intensity and the heat available and the amount of water that we can pack into these storms and therefore the amount of precipitation that falls on land that, you know, can give us storms like Hurricane Florence from a couple years ago.
Well, let's check in with Stephanie Chavis. She's the director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Stephanie, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks, Frank.
It's good to have you here. Well, I guess in a normal year, let's talk about how things have changed now. Evacuation plans, do they change at all for you in the age of coronavirus?
Yes, they do. When we've had prior storms, we used our Southeastern Area Transit System. Sometime we used our school buses. We worked with the public schools, like I said, our area transit systems, the EMS. So now that we've got COVID, we're having to try to make plans and do that keeping our social distancing in mind. When you're dealing with buses, we just, as a matter of fact, had a conference call yesterday, and we're already trying to put some plans in place as to how many people we can put on buses, because as you may know, in Matthew and in Florence, we had anywhere from 1,400 people to 1,800 people that had to be moved from their homes to safe shelters. And if that happens again during COVID, we realize that that process will not move as quickly because of, like I say, trying to evacuate
right.
people and our means of evacuating them.
Well, and would that mean that you're going to have to start earlier? In other words, everybody kind of wants to wait to the last minute to a certain extent. You don't want to have to activate this if you don't have to. On the other hand, you have to be prudent, and I'm wondering if it means we're going to have to start when the storm is farther out to sea because we don't have as much time to get people, you know, in place.
Exactly. As I spoke with my some of my core group yesterday, we decided that as soon as we can, we're having to, of course, you know, do everything by conference calls and virtual conference. But we've decided already that at some point in time, a small group of us need to start going out, revisiting our shelters, maybe even doing measurements of our buses and seeing, okay, let's see how many people we can transport. And we're realizing that we need to do this right away. We don't want to wait because with hurricane season beginning in June, maybe June, July, we'll start this process.
The shelters themselves, forgive me for interrupting, but that would have to change as well. You can't pack people together the way you normally do.
Exactly, exactly. We've got maybe 10, 12 shelters that we normally use, which, of course, are our schools, and we're already looking at. We have a couple of schools that closed last year before the school year began, so I'm going to meet with the school superintendent. And we're going to try to put some plans in place to maybe use a couple of closed schools. And reason being, we're looking at, again, if you're dealing with COVID patients or people that have tested positive for COVID and are supposed to be in isolation but their homes flood, then having to have somewhere to put them. We're looking at hotels. We're looking at closed schools. So there's a lot of planning that is actually having to go into place. Because of COVID, there's a lot of planning has to go in place prior to, even before COVID.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to talk more about this. We'll take a break right here and then come back and talk with Stephanie Chavis, Director of Robeson County Emergency Management, Robert Young, who is the Director of Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The arrival of hurricane season is nothing new for seasoned North Carolinians, but the pandemic has already caused shortages and economic difficulties. Emergency managers are hard at work helping communities who are starting one step behind coming into the hurricane season. I'm talking with Rob Young, Director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University, and Stephanie Chavis, who is the Director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Stephanie, how are you asking communities to prepare this year?
We are working on getting flyers out and doing our social media, or doing different things on our Facebook page, on our county website, so that we can get this information out to her and kind of get our folks to think, as we are thinking right now, that, okay, we're being faced with COVID, but we can't forget about hurricane season.
Is this much different than in other years, or did you do more face-to-face, door-to-door stuff for preparation?
We did more face-to-face then. Mm-hmm. Went out and spoke to community groups. We could send information out through the school system, out, you know, the kids could get little flyers in their book sacks. Well, with the schools being closed, not being able to have gatherings, then yes, it has made it a lot more difficult to get the word out.
And what is that word? What is the information? What are you telling folks to do, and how to be ready?
We have decided that our message this year will just be bring face covering, disposable wipes, disposable gloves, disinfectant, hand sanitizer, any of those items that you can get. We always tell them bring your medications, bring toys for the children, this, that, and the other. But this year we're going to emphasize those items, what we would say PPE, personal protective equipment, or things to help with sanitizing your area and keeping you and your family safe. Those will be the things that we will be telling people this year to have packed up and ready to go in the event that they have to evacuate their homes.
Rob Young, as you hear some of the complications Stephanie is talking about, particularly the fact that you have to, you know, run more buses, and that means evacuation is going to take longer. What would you recommend? I mean, does this mean that we're going to have to issue evacuation orders sooner, maybe sooner than we are sure that this is a dangerous enough emergency? I mean, what would be the recommendation in a case like this?
Well, I think that's one initial obvious solution is that we are going to need a little bit more time for the logistics of these kinds of evacuations. And, you know, I have to say that I'm pretty proud of the state of North Carolina. I think that we have gotten pretty good at handling sort of large-scale evacuations from storm events. We have a very complicated shoreline in eastern North Carolina, and, you know, including the northern Outer Banks. And the local emergency management officials have done an admirable job over the last 10 years of issuing evacuation orders relatively early and having a reasonably high level of compliance. There are always going to be people who like to be tough and ride things out. But I have a high level of confidence that we're going to be able to do this in a way that will make the best out of a very difficult situation. And, you know, there's no perfect solutions to this. These two catastrophes really conflict with each other. You know, to make people safe from a hurricane, we need to put them inside. Right. And that's what you don't want to do with COVID. But if there's a strong storm coming, sure, you're not going to have a lot of choice. You're just going to have to be able to do it in as safe a way as possible. And, I think a lot of folks are talking about that, and that's good.
Stephanie, how are you targeting the needs of high-risk groups in your community?
We have a special needs register or people at high risk, and that has been a lot of our discussion right now, is possibly just having a shelter for those people who are at high risk, or elderly people, people with underlying health conditions, having somewhere to place them just so that they are away from your regular population of folks who may get it, who may be asymptomatic. We just want to make sure we're separating our people. And at the same time, I realize that we have to try to keep family together. But we have to keep in the forefront of our minds that safety and lives come first.
Well, it's not just emergency managers, of course, who are looking out and preparing for other communities and for natural disasters. Larissa Garcon is the executive director of the Episcopal Farmworker Ministry, works with Spanish-speaking communities and migrant farm workers, and she talked with us about how the pandemic is making her work more difficult.
My name is Larissa Garcon. I work at the Episcopal Farmworker Ministry in Sampson County. We work with immigrants and HTA workers in eastern rural North Carolina. And due to the pandemic, I feel like we really haven't been able to put together a good plan to prepare the community for any type of hurricanes that might happen this year. A lot of the information that we provide to the community is done face-to-face, and this is something that we haven't been able to do. And we're concerned about the fact that we work with very vulnerable populations that are going to need more attention, more resources, and more information that is targeting them.
That's Larissa Garcon. She's executive director of the Episcopal Farmworker Ministry, an organization that serves farm workers in Sampson, Johnston, and Heartland counties. I'm talking with Rob Young, director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University, and Stephanie Chavis, director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Stephanie, what have you heard from your community about their concerns? Are people already thinking about this and talking to you? Obviously, we're so overwhelmed with coronavirus, and now we have to think about this. But what are you hearing?
Yes. I haven't had a whole lot of feedback, and that's why we feel like it's important that we soon get our flyers and start getting our information out in every way possible so that we can start, we can get our folks thinking about, okay, hurricane season's coming, but we're faced with the COVID right now, but hurricane season is approaching as well. So, you know, we've got two major disasters going on at one time. We hope not, and if Robert said earlier, emergency management, our world is planning and preparing in order to know how to respond. And part of that is trying to reach out to our people and get them in that mindset of, okay, we're dealing with COVID, but we got to be prepared for hurricanes as well.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects that are going on, both for preparation but also resilience, Rob. What kind of projects are being proposed now that could help with recovery and management, and have any of those been slowed by the pandemic?
Well, certainly there is a tremendous amount of resilience and adaptation work going on around the country now. I mean, since Hurricane Sandy, many of our coastal communities have been in a constant state of rebuilding and development of resilience projects, up and down the East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the U.S. And for some of them, like a beach nourishment project, for example, the epidemic doesn't really slow down the progress of something like that much at all. But for those kinds of projects where you're working with more vulnerable communities, especially inland off the immediate ocean front, helping them try and either rebuild or develop resilience plans for the future, the pandemic does make it incredibly difficult. We need to have face-to-face interaction with these communities. We need community engagement on the ground. And many of the folks that we work with in these rural communities, they're not going to hop on a Zoom conference with you. Mm-hmm. And we can't just sit there in Raleigh or at my desk in the university and develop projects for them without their input. And so this does make the important on-the-ground resilience work that we're trying to do right now quite a bit more difficult.
Talking to Rob Young, who's director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. Rob, is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Frank.
Well, communities at risk for hurricanes are not just worried about the upcoming season. Many are still in recovery from previous storms. And the pandemic certainly has stalled the slow recovery process even further. Laura Hogshead is Chief Operating Officer at the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. She joins us now. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Stephanie Chavis is still with us, Director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Well, let's get an idea of what some coastal communities are experiencing right now in terms of a triple crisis. Hurricane Dorian hit Ocracoke last fall. Tom Paul is Hyde County Commissioner for Ocracoke, and he spoke with us about what the island is experiencing right now.
We're still deep into recovery. We are not through with the recovery by any stretch. We're working hard, trying to get homes put back together, trying to get businesses put back together, and then along came COVID virus and set everything back again. So we're really dealing with two crises at once. And the idea of another hurricane coming along is just, it's hard to imagine how that's going to affect us. It's unthinkable, really. It's unthinkable. And yet we have to think about it. We have to be prepared.
It's Tom Paul. He's Hyde County Commissioner for Ocracoke. My guests are Laura Hogshead, Chief Operating Officer at the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency, and Stephanie Chavis, Director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Laura, welcome to the program. Good to talk with you.
Same to you.
How many communities out there are still living with damage from past storms?
A tremendous number of communities are still living with damage from Matthew, Florence, and Dorian. So we know that 77 communities were declared for federal disasters even before Dorian. So that's 77 of our 100 counties were declared. So almost everyone has been touched in some way by a disaster.
Yeah, your office distributes funding from the federal government to help people rebuild. How is the pandemic affecting your ability to distribute that money?
So we've had to adjust, certainly, but we have not slowed down. We, at this moment, only have funding to address Hurricane Matthew needs. So the Community Development Block Grant for Disaster Recovery Funds that we are in charge of are the funds of last resort. They are the funds that come in after FEMA, after SBA, after everyone has done what they can do. These funds come in to plug those remaining gaps. And so we only have the Hurricane Matthew money. We are anticipating the Hurricane Florence money any day now and are hopeful that HUD will release those funds to us, but we certainly are not slowed down. We were the first in the nation to be approved for our Hurricane Florence action plan and as well for our mitigation action plan. So we've been building the infrastructure over the last year that the office has existed, and we are ready to spend those funds.
But does that mean that that money from the previous hurricanes has to be received and distributed before we can get money from the CARES Act into your community, into those communities?
No, so HUD is working on both at the same time right now. The CARES Act funding is community development block grant funding, and the Hurricane Florence money is a section of CDBG funding specifically for disaster recovery. So HUD is working to put both of those funding sources out now.
Of course, HUD is the federal agency, the Housing and Urban Development Agency at the federal level. Stephanie Chavis in Robeson County, how is your community feeling the lasting effects of past storms?
They are overwhelmed, as the commissioner said earlier. There are still people who are trying to get their homes, otherwise they're in the buyout or they're getting their homes renovated or they're getting their homes elevated. And so they were overwhelmed after Matthew and then when we got Florence. And now they're dealing with COVID because a lot of the people that were out there working and helping them to get this process completed have now been pulled off their jobs. And some of those workers that were out there helping them with their paperwork and getting their funding and all that, they're working from home now. So our folks are still really overwhelmed because of these storms and now with COVID.
Well, Laura, I guess one way to help communities deal with hurricanes in general is to move them out of harm's way when that's possible. And I wonder what the options are for communities that have, you know, to reduce their risk or other options to reduce their risk from hurricanes.
Certainly. Where there are areas that get hit repeatedly, we'll want to eliminate the risk in that area. And if homeowners are amenable, because it is a voluntary program, we are offering buyouts in specific buyout zones across eastern North Carolina. So we are offering pre-storm value for the home and then helping folks relocate outside of the floodplain into other affordable housing.
Where do they go in buyout programs? Where do people move to?
It's their option. We will certainly help them find a place that is safe, but we are leaving it up to them to figure out, and what our role is to build more affordable housing so that they can continue to live in the communities that they love. So we are working with the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency and other partners to make sure that there are options for those who want to leave those low-lying areas.
Is there any federal funding available to build that housing?
Yes, sir. So we are using part of our CDBG-DR allocation for that development.
Generally speaking, what do you find when you go into a community? Is there resistance to buyout? I mean, how do communities feel about it? What are you noticing?
It differs community to community, but I think being hit twice in 2 years with Matthew and Florence, and because so many people were dual impacted by those storms, there is more of an openness now to just going ahead and getting out of that area, and especially if there is an option to remain within the county or remain within that community.
Stephanie Chavis, when it comes to funding in terms of both preparations but also in the aftermath, what are concerns that you're hearing in Robeson County in general? And I guess maybe not just emergency funding, but sometimes the precarity that people find themselves in went before the storm hits, all of those kind of larger funding issues. What are you hearing from people?
With the funding issues, I think a lot of our people, and I agree with Laura, that after two storms, they seem to be a little bit, they're not as reluctant now to move or to get involved in these programs that are offered to them. But a lot of them just get frustrated with the timelines. They don't understand that it's a lengthy process and it doesn't happen overnight. So a lot of them become discouraged, but we try to keep them encouraged and let them know that, you know, this is the process and this is the way it has to be, and just, you know, just encourage them to work with those people that are out there to work with them.
What have you learned, Stephanie, from past storms you think that would help better prepare your community for the future?
Listen to when we put information out. Listen, pay attention, because we're always, like I say, sending alerts out, trying to get information out to our people, keep them educated on what to do. During a storm, we're telling them, we're sending out mass notifications as to places they can go, where disaster recovery centers are set up, what numbers to dial. So we're always trying to keep them informed, and we just encourage our people. We have what's called a COVID mass notification, and we encourage our people to sign up for that. If they're not on the internet or computer COVID, if they're just one of those people that don't care mm-hmm. anything for a computer, then they're not going to be looking at our Facebook page, or they're not going to be looking at the county website. So we ask them, please sign up for COVID, because that's our mass notification, and a lot of that information goes out. And you can get it on your cell phone, your house phone. You can get it through text message. So we've tried to make sure that we're getting information out to our folks in every way possible.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on our program. Stephanie Chavis is Director of Robeson County Emergency Management. Laura Hogshead is Chief Operating Officer at the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. Thank both of you for being on our program.
Thank you, Frank.